Okay. It's a good thing. Good evening. And you're welcome. My name is Nonhlanhla Ncube Ndaba. I'm the chairperson of this portfolio committee. You have only 47 minutes with us. The extra 2 minutes is for the interpreter. But you have 3 minutes to answer a question. 2 minutes is for members to ask you questions. Feel free to ask members a question if you did not hear the member very well, and they will repeat the question. You are advised to try and refrain from bringing preambles, history, background, and so on and so on. Just try your level best to summarize the question as much as you can. It doesn't mean that if you didn't speak for a long time, you did not give an accurate answer. You can summarize your answers as much as you can. Yeah. You have never been a commissioner, ne? OCGE before. Okay. The first question will start with me. As and when honorable members, they are asking you questions, they'll introduce themselves, ne? Yeah. I'm told that you will have to fly back because we have already checked in. But unfortunately, if we prolong the interview, that means your flight will have to be changed, because we must ensure that we do justice to our work. And you must be aware that these interviews are open, transparent. The whole world will be watching you. So as and when you answer, you must remember what day. Everybody is watching. The first question is about yourself. Tell us about yourself. Who are you? Where are you coming from? And why do you think you are a suitable candidate to be appointed as one of our commissioners in CGE?
Thank you very much, Chair, and good evening to everybody. I'm from Gwagwa in the Free State, which is a former homeland. And, you know, as I sit here as a young black woman, I just want to say that it took a series of perfectly aligned miracles for me to get where I am today. Many of my peers didn't make it past the individual struggles and obstacles that they had to fight. And I consider myself lucky, but luck is not what will ensure that the population of South Africa lives in a society that's just, with dignity. And luck will also not enable the youth to transition equitably into adulthood. And over the past 11 years as a medical doctor, I've been in the front line of the issues affecting gender equality, some of which include sexual and reproductive health issues, but of course dignified care and issues of access to equitable care. When the system fails in any form, it leaves many people behind, and many of those people cannot outsource their services or care to private individuals. And in my capacity as a defender for women's rights throughout my career, I've had experiences being a chair of several boards and being a member of some global and local boards in civil society, advising in terms of strategies, in terms of accountability. And I continue to lead in civil society. Someone who's building locally but with very solid global connections. And my deep understanding of the various intersections as people navigate life is really based on a lived experience, but also my expertise as a medical doctor and someone who's worked in public health, but also from the collaborations, you know, whether it's the women from the clinics who are trying to access services, or it's victimization of other fellow human rights defenders in civil society, or just the undergraduate nursing and medical students that I've come in contact with in the past years. The Republic of South Africa is a constitution that is rooted in human rights law and uses this framework to advise in terms of policy, service provision, as well as governance. And the history of this country and the impact of racial oppression and the inequality and economic exclusion requires a very specific interrogation of what it means to be a South African in this modern era, and what it means to have these intersecting oppressive systems continue to be an Achilles tendon for many people who are trying to make it, and so that the most many of us are still stuck in survival mode and are not able to thrive. One of the ways,
Dr. Tolling, I think your time is up. Now you'll expect questions from honourable members, and I take it that honourable members would have read your CV, and I want to hear a question from regarding sexual and reproductive health in one of you honourable members. Thank you very much. Honourable Van der Merwe, Honourable Maisela, Honourable Maluleke, Standa, Tembekwayo, Kaula, and Seke.
Doctor, good evening. I'm Liesel van der Merwe. I do follow you on Twitter, so I'm a fan of yours, and I know that you are indeed.
You know, I'm Honorable Van der Merwe.
Yes.
I forgot to tell her that on Sunday she tweeted something.
About my party. She tweeted something about what? Honourable Grace, in this instance, I was interrupted by your chairperson. So I think in this instance, I'm not in the wrong. Doctor, welcome to Parliament. And as I was saying, I do follow you on Twitter, so I'm aware of some of the projects and some of the good work that you are doing. So it's nice to see you here at Parliament. I wanted to ask you, the CGE unfortunately is very limited in terms of its resources. So it's very limited in terms of its footprint, and some could argue that it's very limited in terms of being able to adequately address issues around gender equality. So if you had to be nominated to become a commissioner, what are some of the focus areas that you would like to prioritize, and how would you be able to assist the Commission for Gender Equality to grow its footprint, its visibility, its reach? And also I would like to hear your thoughts in terms of the fight against gender-based violence in South Africa. Why are we losing the fight? Do you think it's got to do with a lack of policies, or what are your views in this regard? And if you had to be then a commissioner, what would be your inputs around that issue?
Thank you very much, Honourable Lisa. I think one of the expertise that I have as a medical practitioner, especially who's worked in public health, is working with very low resources. And I think the commitment to always deliver quality services is, foremost of all the work that I've been doing as a public health provider. But I do think that, you've alluded to the fact that, is it policy-related, some of the issues that we have. I think South Africa has lauded the world over for very good policies. And what we're lagging behind and letting ourselves down is in the matter of implementation and translating those policies and those frameworks into tangible, accessible services. And I think the CGE is well-placed as an institution that actually is there on the side of the law, and the loyalty is to the Constitution. And in my work and my expertise in terms of cross-movement building, I think one of the things that I can add as a commissioner is how to mobilize resources across fields, across industries, and have the CGE as the glue, because at the moment it seems like everyone is doing something different, but there isn't one central glue that binds all the work. So in terms of gender-based violence and your question specifically, I think what we need to do is bring the people who are in the margins into the center, because people often speak of women as voiceless and powerless, but my argument always is that women are not voiceless or powerless. They are not being heard. And there are reasons why some voices are put at a higher price than other voices, and some are heard and not heard. And even as women within feminist organizations, it's important for us to be aware of our positionality and what we can risk on behalf of the majority, who are very much marginalized and vulnerable, and not by their doing or by their laziness. And I think a lot of, unfortunately, public health campaigning and messaging around gender-based violence is still very much around people avoiding being victims, as opposed to holding those who are the perpetrators accountable. And I think with the investigations, the policing, the justice system, that many victims and survivors feel let down by. We need to explore different ways of what justice looks like in a South Africa today that deals with the crisis levels of GBV that we do deal with, and perhaps starting to think outside of a justice system that currently isn't working. What does justice look like? And we'll only know that by listening to the survivors and those who are victims in terms of what reparative justice looks like. And I think one of my good skills is being quite accessible. I may be a medical doctor and quite technical in that science world, but one of the dialogues that I've held in Gauteng in the 5 city regions was actually around looking at what are the different issues that are affecting communities so that the initiatives are community-led. Because if we are coming with solutions that are tailor-made, we are saying to the community they need to fit to our program, as opposed to doing evaluation and research prior to program design and let the community lead in the implementation, because they will be left, once the programmers have gone, once the funding has dried up. And it's how do we strengthen and build societies that are strong and able to move that on their own.
Thank you very
much. Oh, thank you, Stella. Thank you, Chair. As a commissioner, you are expected to be dealing with variegated manifestations of inequality. And would you please give us 4 drivers which are priorities, the priority ones only, drivers of inequality, and how you would tackle them as a commissioner? That's the first question. The second question is that the nation is a nation because it reproduces itself. Hence, the reproductive chain should be treated with the utmost reverence and care. From conception to the age of 9, a human baby is most helpless in the animal kingdom. What value are you going to enjoin and mobilize all the women that this gap is the most priority of all the priorities that women as a group should look into and champion, because that's the chain that makes us who we are. And most cases, this is the most neglected, because the medical services are not up to scratch as far as this is concerned. Shouldn't we, as commissioners,
Thank you very much, Honorable Maisel. I think one of the biggest principles that I subscribe to personally, but also as a medical practitioner, and the values that I hold, is one of reproductive justice, and that anchors on autonomy, which means people have a right to decide if and when and how many children they want to have, if at all, and how to space those children. That's a fundamental and non-negotiable human right that I subscribe to. And what I do also want to emphasize is that reproductive justice goes beyond to just saying that you have a right to be pregnant or not be pregnant. It actually looks at the society that those people will be born into once they are born. It looks at the support that those people who are carrying the pregnancies are receiving. So the antenatal care and the issues speak to of a lack of comprehensive services to people who are pregnant. And I think at the moment what the focus has been is been on either telling young people to either abstain from having sex, and when they are pregnant, to then just enroll automatically into an antenatal program, and they're already being called mothers. And some of those people haven't even decided if they really want to carry these pregnancies to term. So what we need is health systems that are enabling for people, regardless of your gender, regardless of your reproductive health needs, regardless of where you are in the cycle, to be able to access dignified care that actually will enable you, at least a consultation that will enable you to make informed decisions. And those decisions need to be supported by quality services. If any of those in that link break off, there is no justice, and women will feel oppressed. Women will feel that the system is not catering for them. For example, if you are a young person today, I often say the system is a closed loop. if you were already born with HIV in South Africa, there isn't a program that's speaking to you around your sexual and reproductive health, because most of the campaign is around HIV prevention. But if you had mother-to-child transmission of HIV, there is nothing that's speaking to you. No one is assisting you as a young person. Have conversations with your boyfriend or your girlfriend around disclosure, because often disclosure is something that's left for healthcare providers to do with adults. No one is assisting caregivers, most of the time, which are grandmothers. Some of the parents of the children who were born with HIV have passed on. And no one is assisting the grandmothers, the caregivers, who may not be blood relatives of the young people. How do we tell young people that they have HIV, and that, in fact, this is a chronic illness? And within the context of HIV, how do they have safer sex? Because for them, prevention messaging will not reach them. And the other thing you asked about the drivers of inequality, I think for me, definitely a lack of access to comprehensive and sexual reproductive health and those rights being protected is a driver, not only for just lack of people to thrive, because a lot of young black women, once they are pregnant, they can't get back into the schooling system. Even if you are an older black woman like myself with a degree, if I go on maternity leave, my job is not secure. So women are cutting down their maternity leave just to get back into the job space to secure the employment. So that's one driver, is lack of support for those who do then decide to actually carry pregnancies to term. And I think the other thing, of course, gender-based violence is a big driver, but what's more lacking is the fact that post-violence, those who do survive and are not killed in the violent act of rape or other violence have no services that are 24 hours where they can access help. So not only do you have people who are living with lifelong trauma, but you have people who then have no support in terms of emotional, psychosocial, even social, and definitely not long-term. And research has shown that sometimes when mothers and people in families, especially grandmothers, when they experience trauma, some of that trauma can linger on to generations to come. So I may suffer trauma today, but just because I'm now passed on, it doesn't mean my child will not feel the impact of whatever trauma that I had. And if you take into account the history of apartheid, colonialism, those traumas were never really dealt with as a society. So for me, I think the issue of mental health and wellness in South Africa is something that's lagging. And if you look at all the issues that we have of young people in schools, you know, who are unruly, who are doing drugs, if you look at older persons who do not even have the basic decency of respect and empathy, a lot of what we have to deal with is mental and emotional wellness. And this translates also to health systems, to justice systems, to financing systems, to home affairs. You know, sometimes you expect a certain level of professionalism and empathy when you are a civilian asking for services, and you are not met with that. And therefore, I think when the system fails, for me, that is part of violence in itself, because a lot of the people that depend on systems that work well cannot outsource this to anyone else. Often they're in the rural areas, in the peri-urban areas. Even if they can access a service or they know where to go, they have to save money. I've had patients who save 4 months worth of money just to get a primary health care service, and that in itself is a form of injustice. So I think as a commission, as we look forward to what type of South Africa do we want in the future, we will really have to have deep discussions around how does legislation become inclusive of everybody. If the person who's disabled, who's a transgender individual...
Your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson, and good evening, Dr. Mofokeng. As a medical doctor, I think you were so... When you clarified some of the questions that were asked, you're dealing mostly with reproductive issues, and your experience is based on medical issues. But then I would just want to find out from you, because you are nominated to serve as a commissioner if you are appointed, what do you understand about the CGE? What is the function of the CGE? What are the powers of the CGE? And secondly, how will you ensure that CGE is visible, especially in rural areas? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for that question. So some of the focal areas of the CGE are on gender-based violence, the national gender machinery, gender substantive equality, gender and health, women's economic empowerment, gender, culture, tradition, and religion. And if you look at all of those, the structural, the social fabric of those are all rooted in patriarchy and power dynamics. Who makes it and who gets impacted by what in any of those focal areas are falling down racial and very much gendered lines. And I think as a CTE, the role would be to ensure that not only do you have, I mean, we already have a constitution, which is the framework is human rights. So we already won that battle. But we are stuck in a place where those rights are not being transferred into access, for example, to equitable financial solutions for women. We don't have the, for myself, where I'm standing, the links between the hawkers union. Is there even a women's hawkers union, for example? And we know in a lot of the metropolitans, they are the people who are at the forefront of violence when people are being evicted or being moved away from, selling food where they shouldn't be selling goods. So a lot of the impact when things go wrong, they do fall apart around gendered lines. And as a medical practitioner who's been involved, at places such as the Human Rights Council, at the United Nations headquarters, I know firsthand what global politics can do to drive regional politics, but also then have impact on national politics and what gets funded for and what gets budgeted for. And in terms of the CGE, and I think for me the accountability and the work that it can do, the work is personal. You can't divorce yourself from the daily work that you're doing. And I've been in clinics before where young people would rather wait for me to finish the clinic and have a chat with me in the car park and ask about, a career advice and all of those things. So I may be a medical doctor, but perhaps that comes with its benefits because there is that inherent trust, that doctors still hold in a very specific, important place in society. And I think we can't take that for granted. And so I'm in a place where the fact that I'm a black woman, but I'm a doctor, will still give me better access to spaces than other black girls who may even look like me, but because they are not doctors, they will not be heard. And my position as a CGU commissioner would ensure that those voices are heard and put in the center. I mean, at the UN, we've had representation by South African civil society, people discussing the experiences of rural black women, and we had a white man representing us. Now, not only does that look odd, but it doesn't make sense at all. And that's one of my roles, is how do we bring the voices of the margins to the center? Because the rest of us who are,
Once you continue, I'll minus...
Oh, sorry, Che.
Thank you, Che. At least she's getting a lot in within her 3 minutes. Hi, my name is Terry Stander. I'm a member of the committee. I'm glad that you brought up the UN, because I'm quite interested to hear your opinion about how the CGE plays or positions itself within international and local politics. So you have the Commission for Gender Equality, who represents itself at the UN or SADC, and South Africa gets a lot of accolades having been part of the most progressive constitutions and legislation in the world. But then there's also political opinions and policy. So, for example, perhaps Tibet will not be an important issue, but Palestine will. Or perhaps al-Bashir and Grace Mugabe will get away with something, but other people won't. So how does the CGE, being an influencer internationally and locally, does it engage and represent everyone regardless of government policy, or does it say represent and then come back to South Africa and say, okay, well, our focus is only here on South Africa and we'll just work within the limits. We'll go and talk outside, but we'll talk about South Africa and we are not going to have an opinion on the rest of what's happening.
Thank you very much, Honorable Terry. I think that is one of the biggest potentials that I foresee for the CGE. The fact that we have, regional spaces like the AU, we've got the Maputo Protocol, which is still hailed as some of the progressive, and yet in the region, in terms of translation, we have, countries like Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, where, women are punished for making certain choices, and members of the LGBTIQA+ communities are not just being punished with jail time, but they're actually being killed. And where this commission can really be helpful is being a source of being a resource for our neighbors in the region. As much as we have good policy, the bad experience of lack of implementation is actually quite valuable, because then in terms of other countries like Botswana, like Uganda, like Kenya, who are looking at policy changes from a civil society position, we are able to offer that assistance. And I think the role of the CGE as a resource is something that's not really well tapped into. And across industry, even for governance, even for banking, even for mining, you know, when you're talking about land, but what about land for women? What about environmental rights and environmental justice? When you're talking about menstrual health and hygiene, a lot of the campaigns that emanate from the UN, whether it's UN Women, whether it's UNFPA, do tend to be quite global. But I think my role as a commissioner would be to bring that home. So when you're talking about menstrual health hygiene and the big campaigns at the moment of the pad drives and the recent successes with the lack of VAT, how do we make sure that even menstrual cups make it into the mainstream? Because, in fact, those are a fantastic option. You buy it for one person, you can sponsor it. It lasts many, many years, and it's environmentally friendly because it's not sitting in a landfill the same way that pads and tampons do. So when we start talking about land, when you're talking about environmental rights, when you're talking about custodianship of land, and we still have customary laws that says only men can be chiefs, well, that's a problem. If you're a CGE and you have other laws that are contradicting what as a government, as a country, we are trying to move on. And I think the CGE can really be that bridge between civil society, between what the government is intending to do and all the other different departments, which, again, we have to be honest, don't always talk to each other. But I think we have a good perspective because we are not really involved in the daily governing of the country, but we are also connected very much to community. And that's one of my strong points, is that as someone who's been training just in the last year, I had contact with 450 nurses and young undergraduate doctors, you know. It's how do we make sure that even in undergraduate levels, they graduate being the kind of doctors and medics that we need and nurses. And that's the same for industry. So if you have a banking institute, how do we make sure that the graduates already graduate with that idea of economic justice? And what is the banking system that's enabling of women to not get loans for 25 years? What does that look like in terms of interest rates? You now know the latest scandal of racial differences in terms of, you know, rates. But I can tell you now, it's not just a racial issue, it's also a gendered issue. And I know Honourable asked earlier on about women. What must we do? How do we help women? Women are already raising families on their own. Women are already at the forefront of raising the nation, in fact. And they've been doing it and will continue to do it. What we need to be asking is, why are women being pushed to the absolute limit on everything? And we need to stop glorifying womanhood through struggle. And I think one of the ways the CGE can do is celebrate ordinary women's stories of South Africa that do not exceptionalize suffering, and as a survivor of suffering, then elevate those people to be role models. I think the ordinary South African woman does a lot on a daily basis already, just going from work back home to her children who've been playing with themselves because she has no money for creche or, you know, early developmental care center. So these are the things that women are really at the forefront of. And what do we do when the magistrates' courts cannot enforce the maintenance laws, for example, and make sure that women, you know, are able to care for the children but have the support in terms of the economical resources? So there is a lot, and I think, again, that women get punished for when it's parenting that fails, and we look at it as a women failure. But I think parenting is more than just about women. It is about the people that, you know, made this person, and also the society in general. Because where children don't have parents who are alive, the government should be able to take care of those children.
Thank you very much. Honorable Temboi, I think you have forfeited your 1 minute.
Sure. Sorry. Your last statement during the introductory thing, you stated people are stuck in survival mode and are not able to thrive. If appointed as a commissioner, with reference to you being a speaker, facilitator, or acting on consultancy basis, citing some of the addresses delivered when you were a delegate at the International Convention on Conscientious Objections held in Uruguay, and with the reference to your awards and recognitions, citing the most, like for an example, the most influential young South African in personal development. My question is, how would you use for these awards and the speaker's notes or the speaking notes delivered to pull the people out of the survival mode and at least lead them to thrive on their own, so that the principle of CGE can find a place in their hearts and minds. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Thembagwayo. I think for me, one of the biggest things is that, you know, we have to look at root causes for some of the situations that we find ourselves in. For example, when you look at the issues of global funding and how global health financing is structured, it's still very much a foundation gives a grant to a so-called third world developing country. And those people are supposed to implement this grant. But often this money already comes with conditions that where it can be implemented. Often it comes even with predetermined sites of where it can go. And South Africa is world-renowned for a country that's not only just friendly to research, but friendly to philanthropy and these outreach programs. And what we need to insist in terms of governance, in terms of accountability, in terms of CGE leading that role, is we need to make sure that the funds that are being mobilized for South Africa needs to be, the needs for that money needs to be determined by South Africans. We cannot have foreign countries who are known to only invest to advance their own global foreign policy as some of the people who are we are depending on for our sexual reproductive health services in the country. It makes no sense why sexual reproductive health care and rights are outsourced by the national departments to NGOs, which are funded by foreign NGOs. And we know currently, even in the Eastern Cape, we have right-wing, extreme NGOs that are now part of life orientation in the classrooms. Now, I don't know how many people are aware of this. Virginity pledges are being done in this country, in the classrooms, by NGOs that are supposed to be protecting their idea of the family. Yeah. Now, at the UN, at the CPD, we've spent 4 days and four nights arguing on the definition of the family. And some of the more conservative countries in the world were saying, well, the family is a man and a woman, and that woman has children. And so if that then passes, it means for the rest of the time until the next CPD sets, the rest of the global world can really well just say, well, we're not going to fund any program that's LGBTIQA+. We're not going to fund any program of Gogos or that's run by Gogos because they are not the family. My own child is being raised by my mother, so I can do what I do. Now, in that definition, we wouldn't count as a family. And these are some of the problems that if we leave these things not spoken of, they will then later on set the tone and a culture where people can not only get away with things, but they can set the agenda for the country. And because they have the footprint in the communities, unless you are really deliberate about not only just accountability, but being really sure of who is having access to communities, because the people depend on the government to protect them. And where we fail, again, those system failures are a form of violence in themselves. And you were speaking about, what I would do in terms of the CGE, you know, in terms of where I've been. I think the dream is to replicate, deepen, and amplify. It's maybe in the first two
Your
years.
Time is up. Okay. I think I'll take advantage that Mom's story gave me a question. So I want you to go back to, there was something that you were explaining that is happening in the schools in the Western Cape, coupled it with, say, Young women, they are experiencing problems with regards to cysts in terms of sexual and reproductive health. They're experiencing issues of developing cancer at an early age, cysts, fibroids, and go back to that question and maybe you might try an answer as the Honorable Thembagwayo's question. You were trying to answer it, but your time was up. Can we use that 3 minutes for that?
Yes, I can, Chair. And I mean, speaking, of course, of the issues of the Eastern Cape, where organizations such as Protection of the Family are being given access on demand, basically, to run these programs where they're making young girls sign virginity pledges and take purity promises. in order for them to apparently delay sexual debut. But research has shown that, you know, it's like driving a car. You don't take your child for a driver's license because you're saying you want them to be in an accident and you can actually afford to buy them a car. You're buying them a car to say when you do drive a car, you need to be a safe driver. You know what? You need to know what the rules of the road are. You need to know how to protect yourself and others. And that's how we should be approaching sexual and comprehensive sexuality education in schools. It's to empower young people for whenever they make that decision, that those decisions are empowered and have the necessary depth for them to appreciate the consequences of some of the decisions they make. And coupled with that, there is research that was done at the university currently known as Rhodes, where even in the clinics in Eastern Cape, some of the counseling for women who are pregnant are being done in consultation with a nurse, but with other faith-based organization people sitting in the consultation. Now, that's part of reproductive coercion. So if I'm pregnant and I don't know what to do anymore, it's against the law to push me in any way. And people seem to think that, you know, by telling women and quoting the Bible and be moralistic around healthcare, that will, you know, make women make different choices. But in fact, that's not affirming, that's not empowering, and it's literally against the law. But it's happening because it's rooted in patriarchy and the idea that women don't own their bodies. Again, our jobs are to be incubators for the human race. And the point is, we are not incubators for the human race. The human race needs to find other ideas if it wants to keep reproducing on demand. Women's bodies are not that. And unfortunately, again, as a medical professional, it's not only against professional ethics, but it's also against human rights. You cannot have a consultation with an expert that someone else from a life-based, faith-based organization is from. You wouldn't find that in a cardiology ward. You won't find that in neurosurgery. The question is also, why is it okay for sexual reproductive health services to be outsourced in the manner that they do, but to be funded in the manner that they do? Yes, eventually all the money goes to Treasury, and Treasury will disperse the money. But the point is, we know about the global gag. We know about the Trump-era expansions, which only deepen anxiety and fear for people to implement, in fact, what is not only just constitutional in the Bill of Rights, but in South Africa, with a very specific care around the choice on termination of pregnancy. But in terms of cysts and cancers and young people who are experiencing reproductive health issues much earlier, this for me is a very political issue and very personal one, because I don't think as a country we've really quantified the impact and the effects of apartheid, which was legislated violence, and how the apartheid state used the health system to control the bodies of black women, but also show the disregard for the lives of black people in general. Even the laws that were restricting certain procedures or certain access to health care, no one really cared what happened to black women. It was around protecting the white babies so that they can then have white imperialism and white domination, because you can't have white domination without a white army. So the fact that black women were dying in the rural areas, in the townships, in the fields, no one cared about that. So the restrictions were really never about us not accessing care. It was actually around white supremacy. And unless we look at these legislations in the face and really look through things with a fine comb, we are going to find, as we are right now, as a constitutional democracy, still perpetuating those same principles in healthcare that were never meant for the majority. That's why people are never satisfied with healthcare. That's why when you get to the clinic, you feel like this place is not for me. So not just in policy or implementation, but just structurally, the space itself is violent. And I think a lot of women can retell stories of how they used to bleed without menstrual pads. And that still happens to inmates in South Africa. Not a decade ago, a few years ago, the CGE did a report on the state of health and wellness for female inmates. So we need to really look back at the policies that we're implementing, because if we're not doing that, is it any wonder that people still feel oppressed? They may not have the technical language or the fancy explanations, but oppression feels, there's a feeling. You get that feeling and you know what it looks like. And if we're going to say people must write to the CGE, download a Word document, fill it in, rescan it, how will the Gogos and Gwagwa do that? So even how people report and engage with the CGE needs to change. Because it means by not being able to access us, it means we also can't hold people we are meant to hold accountable. And the issue of Depo Provera and how that was used, I mean, South Africa and these very buildings was kicked out of the International Family Planning Federation years ago. because of how apartheid ministers at the time were wanting to use that drug, and we were kicked out. But no one is asking why is it in 2019 that is still the dominant contraception of use in this country when we know the effects of it. In year one, you can lose 40% of your bone density that you may not regain back. So when the older women go back from the urban areas and they retire as domestic workers, they are back in the rural areas, their spines are bent, they've got osteoporosis, they probably had falls that no one even x-rayed or even managed properly. They look physically deformed, and people will burn them and call them witches, right? Because they have babies at their back, while people like myself can be in Johannesburg working while our children are being raised by our mothers. And this is the injustice, the generational injustice that I refer to when I say the traumas that happen to women, specifically black women in South Africa, the impacts of those will be felt for generations to come. And we need to start seeing the links between the different types of ways that the system lets people down and how many of those people, no matter where they go, you cannot access care, but everyone judges you. If you're a black young woman, they tell you, take contraceptions, why are you pregnant? But when you go to the clinic, they shout at you and call you other names. So you leave. So you get pregnant. And then because you can visibly see that you've been having sex, you get shamed. When you go to a hospital, there's a nurse with a Bible and another preacher who tells you what a bad person you are. So you leave again. And when people see you at 9 months in the classroom, they tell you that this is not a maternity ward, it's a school. You then leave school, you go give birth, and you can't come back because now you are over the limit. And there are no Abbott cottages as much as people think they are. So where do these young women go? Because they are being failed by the system repeatedly, and no one is taking accountability. But it's easy, of course, to just call them names, you know, because they are the easy target. But the CGE has to be unrelenting and absolutely focused on dealing with the root causes, not just of illness, but of social injustice. And realize that unless we're going to look at every legislation in this country and make sure that the remnants of apartheid are done away with, and when we mean access to services, we mean literal access to service. If I must still save, I get people, Honorable Lizelle was talking about the Twitter, I get tweets all the time, regardless of where I am, trying to link people to services. Sometimes I can help, sometimes I can't. But the impact of that, it means as an individual person, I'm taking the brunt of the system failure, and I don't have the budgets that they are working with. And when they don't respond to your emails, they don't engage at all, so who do I go and speak to? And I think this is what we need to look at, is that the people that we go to for help are themselves feeling hard done by the very system that they work under. So if you are a police woman and you must take 5 statements of someone who's been beaten, and when you go home at night, you are that woman who's being beaten, and tomorrow you come back to work and you are taking more statements, how can you possibly carry on without ever breaking? And unfortunately, again, because women are in the forefront of accessing service, it almost feels like, oh, women don't like other women. But that's just how it is.
Thank you very much. Your time is up. Okay. It's new things, ne? Yeah? Who was next? There? Who was?
Time. You know, I'm not afraid to tell the chairperson. Time.
So who was next? We're about to vote in the House.
Oh, I think, Chair, my question, I think it was covered by Dr. Dlaleng, broad in terms of your answer, in terms of your answers. But just to check your employment and or consultancy, your agency. But I'm fine. I think I wanted to check if you'll find in your busy schedule whether you'll find space and time to dedicate your life to the CG, to the work of the commission.
I'll never be too busy for my country.
Dr. Dlaleng, thank you very much for coming. We wish you good luck because you're flying out.
Yeah? We're coming back.
Yeah, I'm good.
Are you both here?
No. I can go anytime I want. Like, I have to finish the report. Relax yourself.
I'm gonna put tea.
Thank you.
I can't watch Champions League.
He actually helped me open my door.
What door? But the dome?
And home. No, it will not start. Oh, come on.
You can fly from New Zealand today and arrive in Los Angeles yesterday.
Crazy.
That's fine.
You
don't know that one.
She was deep.